So, good morning to all. We're setting out on our exploration of Sangharakshita as teacher. It occurred to me as I was walking here that Buddhism begins with dukkha in Sangharakshita's exposition. In the Survey of Buddhism, he discusses where Buddhism begins and why it begins there, taking off from an old paper of his. Begins with dukkha. And it doesn't just begin with dukkha. Dukkha goes all the way through. The main sort of tool we've got, in a sense, for our spiritual lives is the experience of dukkha in one or other form. And I'm hoping that you're going to experience dukkha in this seminar. The Dhammapala College is very kindly offering you the opportunity to experience dukkha. I know you don't experience any generally, Satchika, so I thought I'd better supply some for you. So, when you're listening to what I've got to say and what my venerable colleagues have got to say in the groups, well, you may experience dukkha on various different levels. First of all, you may experience dukkha in the sense that what you're hearing doesn't really make sense to you. It doesn't add up. It will really add up in Sagramati's case, but you won't have understood it. But if you sort of think about what you've heard and notice the points at which there's a sense of disquiet, because you don't really understand, it doesn't really quite add up. This is a very serious point that I think it's attending to these experiences of disquiet, of discomfort, that really are the fuel of our spiritual life. For instance, in the moral sphere, it's listening to that sense of, I didn't like what I did there, and noticing that and then acting upon it. So in this sort of sphere, it's first of all noticing the disquiet that comes from not having understood. Don't just switch off. That's what we often do. We just switch off and think about something else and then come back in later. Try to notice where you don't really see it adding up. And that's something to follow through in the groups. Then there's another level to that. It's where you may understand, or at least think you've understood what's been said, but you find that you have a disagreement with it, or you find yourself in conflict about it. And again, it's extremely important to notice that sense of disquiet, discomfort. I think very often, again, we just sort of smooth it over, push it to one side, don't attend to it. But noticing the points at which there's a sense of disquiet because what you've heard you don't intellectually agree with or experientially agree with, a very, very important key to practicing the Dhamma. But it goes even deeper than that, because you may find that, yes, you've understood what's being said, you think yourself in agreement with it, but underlying that, there's a sense of dis-ease, of discomfort. In other words, something much deeper in you is challenged by it. And in a way, if you allow yourself to become fully conscious of it, what you're aware of is that you know it's true, but you wish it wasn't. And you don't really want to take it in. And that is the main thing that you're trying to get at, is that deeper sense of resistance to the Dhamma is the most difficult thing to get hold of. Most of us, in a way, have a broad, general, intellectual grasp of the Buddha's understanding of things. We know that everything is impermanent. We're not in disagreement about that. Most of us here, at least. I hope all of us here, at least. But, of course, our very actions show that we're not really fully in agreement with that. A deeper down, underneath the level of thoughts, of concepts, we're not in agreement with it. And it's that one has to try to get out in the open and work on. If you don't bring it out into the open, what's likely to happen is that you'll rationalise it. And you'll rationalise it in terms of intellectual or theoretical or merely practical ways away from it. So, what I'm hoping is that we will engage in a real sort of encounter with the Dhamma through Sangharakshita as teacher, as presented by me and my colleagues and by Bhante himself. And I'm hoping that that encounter will clarify anything that's unclear. You just don't really understand. It will give you the opportunity to explore any areas of disagreement that you have at the intellectual level. But most of all, it will get down to that underlying dis-ease, that underlying sense of discomfort when the light of the Dhamma shines upon you. If you don't feel that discomfort, it's either because you're already enlightened or because you're just not really facing up to the fundamental resistance, as it were, the fundamental clinging to selfhood, to Atman, to Svabhava, to own being. So I'm hoping that through our process of exploration, our threefold process of exploration, accompanied by meditation and puja, which is a fourth dimension to it, we'll get a little bit deeper to grips with the Dhamma. And on the way, I hope, understand much more clearly what Sangharakshita as teacher means. Because in a way, that's the function of a teacher. The teacher's function is to confront you with the Dhamma. Well, confront sounds, you know, unnecessarily confrontational. You may experience it like that. The teacher's function is to shine the light of the Dharma on you. And your response to that is, in your hands. So, I had some very definite ideas about how I was going to present this morning, but when I sat down to prepare, I found my thoughts going in a different direction. And I found myself immediately just reflecting on the fact that I am a disciple of Sangharakshita. And I have been since 1969, which I've lost the ability to add up such huge numbers, but I think is probably getting on for 40 years. 38 years, I think. Funnily enough, I had some experience of Bhante before I met him, before I went to the centre in London and met him. I lived quite near where he lived, and I used to go walking on Hampstead Heath quite regularly, usually fairly stoned. I know the dope that we smoked in those days is nothing compared with today's dope, but anyway, it was good enough for us. And one day I was coming back from Hampstead Heath, and I saw a figure walking towards me. An immediately striking figure, because that figure was wearing a long brown cloak, sort of held closed in front of him. And again, when I sort of caught my attention by when my attention was caught by that, I noticed that this figure was an older man, but with long hair. And my attention caught a bit more closely. And I remember so clearly, I can see it in my mind's eye now, this figure walking along with an extraordinary sense of self-possession, like something I'd never seen before. As if a deep sense of seriousness of purpose, as if he knew exactly what he was doing, and no distraction, mind not flitting here and there, just walking along, but not in a sort of obsessive way, not as if he was fixated on something and, you know, hurrying to get there, but as if he was completely concentrated in the act of walking. And I didn't really make this very conscious at the time, but this is the way I thought of it at the time. And it later emerged that it was a Sangharakshita. I do also remember seeing him at the Rolling Stones concert in Hyde Park, which was a memorial to Brian Jones. when they did a, I think it was about a half hour of Sympathy for the Devil. Anyway, we won't go into that, even though this is the 40th anniversary of the 60s. And I remember Bante there, picking his way through the crowds. He swears that he was not there. It must have been particularly good acid. Anyway, hastening on, you know us old hippies can get very stuck in the 60s. From 1969 onwards, I really took him as my teacher. Not sort of thinking that to myself, but that's really what it amounted to. I put myself very much under his tutelage. And as time went on, I came to work very closely with him. I was his secretary for about 8 years. When I was first involved, I sometimes would drive him around. And I remember, you know, sitting outside the place where he was going, in the front seat of the front seats of the car, just talking about the Wheel of Life, talking about the 12 Nidanas, talking about various aspects of the Dhamma. And, you know, it must have been very elementary stuff, but Bante answering in such an interesting and living way, obviously from his own experience and understanding, made a very deep impression on me. After I'd become ordained, I worked in London and helped to set up the London Buddhist Centre. After that, I went to Greece for 3 months to write a book about the FWBO. And I didn't know what I was going to do when I came back. When I got back, I found that I was to be Sangha Exeter's secretary. Nobody asked me. Nobody, you know, consulted me. My things had been moved to Padmaloka. And I discovered that's where I was bound. And, you know, it was quite right. And he was perfectly entitled in the nature of our relationship to do that. I had no hesitation or question about it. Okay, that's what I'm going to do. Would that I'd kept up the same sort of spirit more later. But at the time, that's the way I sort of thought, that if he wants me to do that, of course I'll do that. And what an extraordinary opportunity. You know, for quite a long time, I saw myself as mainly serving him, as serving the Dhamma through him, which is an extraordinary opportunity that very, very few people have had. Of course, it's not always been easy. I've had long periods at times of perplexity about him. You know, he's a definite personality. Everybody must be. Even the Buddha was a definite personality. And, personalities don't necessarily easily go together. Ours do in many ways, but there are areas of dissonance which, you know, I didn't have the self-knowledge to understand, at least initially, which caused me quite a bit of pain and doubt at times. I don't say anything about him in this. I'm just talking about my own responses to the inevitable sort of interaction at a merely sort of phenomenological sense of personalities. I've seen inevitably the doubtful outcomes of some of his decisions and actions. Although usually they're not what people think they are, or what people who don't know him speculate they are. At times he's ridden me hard. Probably he wouldn't have thought of it like that, but that's the way it's felt, as if there's a rider on my back with very sharp spurs. I've bucked, I've even thrown the rider and run away at times. But I've usually come back, always come back so far. It's a very, very difficult when you're a prathagjana, an ordinary mortal, to be in connection with somebody who is relentlessly clear and self-possessed, who is ruthlessly objective, doesn't spare himself or others in terms of analysis. And of such extraordinary breadth and depth of learning and of sensibility. Remember one of the most extraordinary experiences I had with him. I went with him to Paris when he was on his way down to Italy. And we visited the Musée Cluny, the Museum of Medieval Art in Paris. And I remember very clearly, again, we were looking at some ivories, tiny little ivories from that sort of wonderful period of medieval art in French culture. And I sort of looked at them, you know, with that museum kind of numbness that comes over. You just see about 40 little plaques and kind of can't quite get into them. But I remember Banti just sort of pointing to one of them and saying, look at the lines of that. And immediately it sprang into clarity that this tiny little piece of ivory was a perfect, harmonious work of art. And I found that in many, many spheres, his taste, his judgment in literature, in art, is well worth engaging with. Extraordinary depth of sensibility. But all of this can be a bit much, frankly. It's a bit much. If only he was, you know, a little less present, and if only he was at times, you know, so swore and then said, oh, sorry, etc. Yes, it's a bit much. However, he's always been personally very kind, interested in me, sympathetic, helpful. Yes, sometimes obviously has no idea what a psychological problem is. And, you know, doesn't sort of quite do what you want him to do in that respect. But my own overall experience of him has been as a very kind, helpful, attentive person in my life. Of course, he's not always had time for me. He's had so much on. I've not got a privileged sort of position in that respect. Perhaps nobody does. But it's very difficult for me to think of my life without him. I've no idea where I would have been, what it would have been like. I tend to think it wouldn't have been a very happy one. When I look at my brothers, or my brother particularly, eldest brother, who had very similar character to me and came from a very similar background, his life, poor fellow, was in the broader terms, a good one, but it was quite a mess and not a happy one. And I tend to think that would have been the way of my life. And Bante's definitely seen in me what I couldn't see in myself, and helped me to bring out what I couldn't have brought out without him, I don't think. So, I can't help but confess all that, as it were, when I'm going to talk about Sangharakshita as teacher. I want you to know quite clearly that, awkward fellow as he can be, he's very much my personal teacher, the major influence in my life, way beyond anybody else. Of course, in a sense, even beyond my parents, although they've influenced me in certain more fundamental ways, human terms, he's influenced me so much more in the broader sense. He's never presented himself as perfect. He's never asked for obedience or sort of blind belief. And he's mainly, I think, communicated himself to me through his personal example and, more than anything, his sort of presence. Through my contact with him, I've felt myself to be in contact with a deeper dimension of experience, which is very difficult to sum up in any sort of way. Funny, something I often forget. If I haven't seen him for 3 or 4 months and then I go and see him, I sort of think, oh God, I've forgotten about this. This very strong sense of self-possession, a very subtle mindfulness, and a sense that he's seeing things that I don't even know I don't know, if you see what I mean. A sense of a certain uncanny presence. And that's the essence of it for me, is the contact between me, an ordinary personality, and somebody of a very definite difference of order, as it were. He's made himself available to me, particularly through media that I understand, in other words, through work and through Dhamma, teaching. He makes himself available to others in other ways. And I've, to some extent, perhaps a large extent, opened up to him. I've taken him seriously. I've allowed him to affect me. At times I've squirmed like a fish on a hook. At times I've even got away. But something about him has always brought me back. And yes, I've continually renewed my sense of him as the person I've experienced in my life most to be taken seriously. Taking seriously what he says and what he does, of course, but more deeply sort of what he is, a certain presence, if you like. You know, for instance, I've had experience of meditating with him, and somehow from him I've picked up a sort of deeper meditative experience. Not that he's given it to me, but being in his presence puts one in contact with a deeper level of meditative experience than I'd had before. So yes, if you open up to the influence of a person like that, even though it may be ambiguous, maybe at times there are rough edges or whatever, if you take them seriously, it'll affect you. It'll spark you off. It'll open something up within you. Even what one may consider to be mistakes require reflection. Even the things that some of us do think have been unfortunate about Bhante's actions in the past, you can't just dismiss them. You need to understand him. You need to reflect on them. They may still be mistakes in the sense that misfortune has come from them, but they're not very likely the mistakes that you think they are. So he really makes you think. He makes you consult yourself more deeply. He makes you change. That is the function of a spiritual teacher. And that is the function that Sangha Rakshita has performed for me. Sometimes, very definitely, a teacher will function, as it were, against your will. I talked of that deeper sense of resistance. And sometimes a teacher will, as it were, do something that comes up against that deeper resistance. And Sangha Rakshita, I think it's fair to say, is not a comfortable teacher. I sometimes wish I'd found another teacher who was all nice and cuddly. But he's not that sort of teacher. He's likely to have views that are against the tide. And he's very likely to enunciate those quite clearly. For instance, to grasp the nettle by the nettle. What's the term? Nettle by the leaf. His views on men and women. Enough said, all right, I'm off. But yes, he says something about that. And you know, if you're a disciple of Sangha Rakshita, if you've touched something of this depth in him, you can't just say rubbish. You may not be able to say yes, but you can't just say rubbish. And you have to sort of hold yourself in relation to that, remaining true to your own thoughts and experience, but recognizing that those thoughts and experience may not be deep enough. It's a very, very difficult sort of tension to hold yourself in. And that, I think, is the kind of teacher we've got. There you are. If you don't like it, there are others. But probably anyone that's worth his salt, or her salt, will confront you in the same sort of way, so that you experience your resistance. And you're going to have to work that through. Not just by saying, I believe, but not by saying, rubbish, this is not what we believe nowadays. But what is most deeply committed is very difficult to define. What is communicated most deeply is very difficult to define. It's not any theories or institutions or practices or something like that. It's the very point of view of the Dhamma. Sangha Rakshita, a spiritual teacher, is looking from that point of view much more deeply and thoroughly than you are. And when you're in contact with that sort of person, you look at it too. You, perhaps reluctantly, perhaps rather clumsily, you come to share that perspective, at least for a while. And that sharing of the perspective changes you. You can't quite go back where you were. But I stress, it's not the point of view in a conceptual sense, it's an experiential point of view, an existential point of view, even a non-conceptual point of view. So Sangharakshita is a teacher of a very unusual and uncompromising kind. He sometimes has said that, you know, you can compare people to various plants or flowers. And he thinks that if he was to be compared with any plant or flower, it would be a thistle. Scots like this, of course. But a thistle is actually rather a beautiful a flower, but it's definitely a prickly one. Yes. German, everybody know? Sunaka, you clear on thistles? Yeah. Yes, a very beautiful, you know, lovely purple seed. You have them in America, don't you? Yeah, of course you do. but yes, definitely a prickly plant. And there's something very much of that kind about Sangharakshita. They also grow in rather difficult places, and they spread like wildfire. Yes, there's something definitely of an uncompromising and rather awkward kind about the man. You'll find out in a few days, although he may be sweetness itself. And there's something rather uncanny about him. You can't pin him down. And very obvious, he sees much more than he says. Now, everything I've said so far is as one who's had 38 years of contact, of consistent contact with him, and of very privileged media of communication. I've communicated with Bhante, particularly in our shared commitment to the order and movement, in our shared commitment to creating and evolving it. And that's given me a very definite medium of communication with him. I still have fairly regular contact with him. I've had that sort of influence from him. But what about those who don't have that? Or who are unlikely to have it? Because, you'll see, these are a really now quite old man. And we just don't know how long he's going to last. His body is definitely fading. New generations are going to come who've never encountered Sangharakshita. What of you? Some of you now have the opportunity to meet him. But you don't have sometimes the uncomfortable benefits of direct personal connection. You haven't had the privilege of being shaken up just by regular contact with him, albeit always in a kindly context. Although you can still meet him, he's very open to visitors, and you can take advantage of him as you're doing by participating in this event. But even though you don't have that sort of access to him that I've had, you have got what we didn't have in the early days. And sometimes I think the trade-off is pretty even, if you see what I mean. That what you have now is in some ways the equivalent of and equal to what we had in those early days, when there was pretty much Sangharakshita, a pile of cushions and some tea. You've got now a whole rich and complex world which comes, as it were, out of Bhante's interaction with us. We've got an order, a movement, centres, this very gathering, all assembled out of his teaching, and all of which provides a far more effective context for putting the Dhamma into practice than we had in those early days. Yes, we had that sort of direct experience of an extraordinary man. But in a way, we didn't have the context to do much with it. is only slowly evolved. This leads us into a very, very important idea in Buddhism, which is not much discussed, but which I think is very relevant to this particular discussion. It's this idea of a sasana. It's sometimes said that we live in the Buddha sasana. In other words, the sort of sphere of influence of the Buddha spreading down through history. It's said that at some point the Buddha sasana, this Buddha sasana, will end when all the physical remains and even teachings of the Buddha have disappeared. But it's a very sort of interesting and important word, I think. It's sometimes translated as dispensation, and its roots, as far as I can see, the scholars will probably correct me later, as scholars love to do. They'll probably correct me, but what I've understood is it's connected initially with royalty, I suppose what in England would have been called the Queen's Peace. The jurisdiction, I think you'd say in the American context, the king's writ, that the sphere within which the king's law would be obeyed, and would be not just obeyed, but would be enforced through justice. So there's a sort of equivalent in the spiritual sphere. A man like the Buddha has a lasting impact on a whole set of people rolling through the ages. We here are here in the Buddha's dispensation, in his sasana. Not just in terms of the formal sort of images and teachings and so forth, but of a whole sort of mood and atmosphere, even culture, which has come down to us. We live in the Buddha sasana. The influence of the Buddha has reached us. But a Buddha sasana, especially as time goes on, becomes less and less directly related to the circumstances of the times. The Buddha's original teachings, they still are relevant in terms of their principles. But sometimes the practice, the means of expression and so forth, is not immediately relevant to us. The huge wealth of the Buddha's teaching may not all find an immediate way into our experience. So a Buddha requires those who refresh, well, not refresh, because it doesn't need refreshment, but who can make the Buddha's teaching relevant in particular circumstances and situations for particular people. There's a very interesting teaching of Sangharakshita's, which talks about the role of a Buddha, a Guru, and a Manu. The Buddha, his role is to set the wheel of the Dhamma turning again when it's completely disappeared. So the Buddha brings the Dhamma to life again in a particular historical time when it's disappeared altogether. And the Buddha, his chief abiding function is to establish the essential principles and teachings of the Dhamma, and to establish a Sangha that can keep the teachings alive. But the Buddha can only function in a direct way for those who immediately surround him. He can function to some extent as guru to those who are his own immediate disciples. But down the ages, what's required is a guru who will take the Buddha's teaching and refer it to the particular individuals who confront him or her, and to the particular culture that they're in, who will make the Dhamma immediately practically relevant. There's a very important distinction made in the Dhamma between the Dhamma and the Vinaya. Vinaya now has a rather narrowed meaning in terms of the code of ethics of the bhikshus, but seems to have originally had a meaning something like, well, the Dhamma as the essential principles and the Vinaya as the precepts and practical applications of the Dhamma. The Vinaya needs constant restatement in the Vinaya in this sense, or sometimes it's Sikaya the training. It needs constantly refocusing in order to make it immediately relevant. So that's the function of the guru. And this is the function that clearly Sangharakshita has performed in relation to us. Manu is another conception. The Manu is the one who makes the principles of the Dhamma relevant within society for those who have no particular interest in following the Dhamma in a committed sense. And this is perhaps part of the function that Sangharakshita has performed under Dr. Ambedkar's dispensation in India, is to try to make the Dhamma, the principles of the Dhamma, the ethical principles, the social principles of the Dhamma, live for people in a society where many are not going to be interested in a personal commitment. So anyway, the Manu we can leave on one side, but Buddha and Guru, I think, sort of shows the relationship between someone like Sangharakshita and the Buddha. His function is to work within the Buddha Sasana to refresh, to revitalize, to make relevant the principles of the Dhamma to people within a particular culture and time. Very, very different. Especially different now. I think we live in times that have a radical discontinuity with the past. So this is one of the functions also of the Bodhisattva. Because a Bodhisattva, isn't a Buddha yet. A Bodhisattva functions within the dispensation of the Buddha. And one of the vows we find of the Bodhisattva traditionally, even said to be one of the Bodhisattva's ethics, is Gana Parigraha Shilena, the ethics of gathering a community. The Sangha goes into this in the chapter on ethics in a very, very interesting way. So the Bodhisattva's function is to gather a crowd, to gather a community of people around him by performing an act of gathering, whatever that may be, by sort of fascinating people around, and then creating a kind of world, if you like, providing for them materially, giving them the cultural context that they require so that they're supported psychologically, emotionally, you might say, humanly, and the elements that will discipline them, keep them on within Shila, and the elements that will help them to develop on the path more deeply. That gives teachings and practices. So what the Bodhisattva does is form not just a community, but all the elements of a world in miniature, a society in miniature, which provides people with what they require in order to develop. He assembles as best he can, of course, with the aid of disciples, because one of the wonderful features of this sort of world is that you're not merely victim, you're agent. As you join in that community, you become part of its formation. You participate in forming it. And, well, we're very conscious of that, those of us who've been around a long time. We've done a lot of work under Sangharakshita's tutelage, and many of you will already be participating in that sort of activity, passing it on. So it's not that the Bodhisattva does it all, but the Bodhisattva leads. The Bodhisattva leads the way and provides the spiritual depth and vision which sparks others off to participate with him or her to create this sort of this world which is imbued with the Dhamma and in which the Dhamma can be lived out. And within that, people will get as much support, encouragement, even challenge, even discipline in the strict sense, to develop themselves as individuals. So the way I thought of this increasingly is that it amounts to a kind of system of spiritual training, spiritual discipline even. I caught this from a chance comment of Bhante's in The Three Jewels. He talks about the integrity of a system of spiritual discipline. So you've got different schools of Buddhism, each of which has its own system of spiritual discipline, which to some extent are exclusive. They don't necessarily immediately translate. You may, of course, at a deeper level they do, but you may not be able to immediately reconcile them. So each one is a complete system of spiritual training or discipline. And that's the function of a bodhisattva, to create a community imbued with a system of spiritual training, which they're putting into practice. A whole world or culture. Ultimately, in the Mahayana, it was considered that the function of the bodhisattva is to literally create a world. This is the idea of the Pure Land. The Amitabha is the Buddha who emerges out of the bodhisattva activity over beginningless time. And he's got to the point where he's able to sustain huge numbers of beings. Anybody who calls his name, according to the myth of Pure Land, can be reborn in that world, which is a world in which the Dhamma is immediately and directly and relevantly open to everyone. Sitting on your lotus, if you're not very developed, it's fully closed, so you can't feel it very much, but you can feel something of the warmth of it. The light of the Dhamma shines upon you. So that, at a mythic level, who knows, maybe even at a real level, I'm open to that possibility. That's the function of a bodhisattva. The bodhisattva tries to create a sort of world in the human sense, a world within a world. Not a world cut off from the wider world, but a world within the wider world which sustains the development of the individual. And this is, to my mind, very much what Sangharakshita has done. He's gathered a community, he's created a sort of world through which the Buddha's influence can come to us as mediated by Sangharakshita's understanding and exposition. But my own view is that if you give yourself to that world in a wholehearted way, in the right spirit, it will carry you as far as the path goes. So let's just look a little bit more closely at what this world is, what this system is. I'm going to be dealing with it over the next talks under four headings. It's a system of views and ideas. Ideas about the way things are. Ideas about practice and so on. It's a system of practices, even customs and rituals and so forth, so that for instance, there are definite practices that you do. Those practices are organized in a particular way. There's pujas to do and so on. There are celebrations to participate in. Then it's a system of human relationships where people have particular responsibilities in relation to each other, where people stand in particular declared positions. For instance, if you're an order member, well, you've declared yourself publicly to be devoted, committed to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. When you become a mitra, you've declared that you want to approach the Buddha and Dhamma and Sangha much, much more fully through your connection with the order. So it's a system of human relationships where we stand in relationship to each other on the basis of a certain understanding of the nature of human communication. And then finally, it's a new society and culture. First of all, of institutions, certain institutions that support the views, the practices and the relationships. Then of a wider vision of societal transformation. That, for instance, in India now affects tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people. So difficult to realize that when you're 30 people and you rejoice that you've got so many together. We Indians, we find this a little laughable. So all of this functioning at its best, these views, these practices, these relationships, this society, when it's functioning at its best, which of course it never does, carries of the influence of Sangharakshita, which is the influence of the Buddha through Sangharakshita to us. I think, by the way, the fact that it is imperfect is part of its effectiveness. is part of the practice itself. I'll leave you with that one. This system is integral. It all works together. The ideas, the practices, the institutions, the relationships, they all form a whole. And you can't easily detach bits from it or add bits to it. It requires quite an effort of understanding and of appreciation. It's not that you're saying that other systems are wrong or bad. You've not necessarily got any view on that. Although you may have. It's not to do with other systems. It's not saying this is the best. It's saying this is the one for me, the one that I'm engaged with. And ultimately, you need to be engaged with a system. You can't get to the end of the spiritual path without engaging in training. I often say that if you want to get water out of a well, you need to drop your bucket to the bottom. There's no point in dropping your bucket a little bit down a lot of wells. You don't get more water that way. You have to drop your bucket right to the bottom of the well. So you need to engage yourself with a system of training in a very deep and intense way. You may exhaust that system if it's not a full system, but you need to have engaged with it in a very deep intense way. The Buddha, after all, exhausted the teachings of Alara Kalama, but he went right to the end of those teachings. So yes, it all hangs together. You can't detach things from it readily. You can sometimes, but not easily. You can't add things to it easily. You can do it, but it requires a conscious intelligent work to do so. To take a simple example, the mindfulness of breathing. Well, we do the mindfulness of breathing not just as a detached element. Of course, we teach it like that, but as quickly as possible, I hope, we put it into a context, a system. In the system of meditation. So that there are attitudes and approaches that you occupy, that you apply within the mindfulness of breathing that come from those ideas. If you have different ideas, you won't apply yourself in the same sort of way and you won't get the same sort of result. So for instance, if you approach the mindfulness of breathing as a thoroughgoing materialist who believes only in the physical body and that the mind is merely a sort of byproduct of the physical, well, you'll approach the experiences that you begin to have that go beyond the merely physical in that sort of way. You may think they're simply aberrations or just sort of strange kind of organic accidents or whatever. But you won't give them credence, you won't give them belief, you won't occupy them with full existential conviction. Oh, I even said that like Sangharakshita, didn't I? Existential. You won't really get inside the practice itself. Or if for instance, you've got ideas that you do find around in other universities of Buddhist discourse that dhyana is to be avoided, you won't be able to do the mindfulness of breathing with full conviction, because mindfulness of breathing, believe it or not, if you do it wholeheartedly, leads to dhyana. So your ideas, the ideas that underpin the practice, affect what you experience. And I think a lot of people's problems with meditations are unclear thinking about meditation. But it's not just that. You know, a lot of what holds us back in meditation is unresolved sort of self-experience. You know, you've got a lot of tangle in your mind, and when you meditate, that's sort of looping around there. The things that, you know, you want that you haven't really made clear to yourself, the problems that have arisen in your life in the past. Well, you need to do something about that. Otherwise, it's very, very difficult to push through in meditation. And, well, spiritual friendship is the key way to resolve these sort of issues within your mind. And that the understanding that Sangharakshita has of spiritual friendship allows an interaction within which you have the opportunity to resolve these sort of barriers within your mind. Again, why don't people succeed in meditation? I often find that people think there's something problem with the technique. They haven't got the technique right, or they haven't got the right technique. But it's so obvious why they're not succeeding in meditation. You know, for 40 minutes a day, they're doing one thing, and then for 23 hours and 20 minutes, they're doing something completely contrary to it. Maybe when they're sleeping, they relax a bit. But, you know, a lot of your day, you're filling your head with information, you're conceptualizing, you're getting lost in your own desires, you're not really fully aware of yourself, you're on a computer and you're miles away, whatever. People are not living in a way that's consonant with the effort of meditation. So, you know, of course you're not going to have an experience. It's not the poor, wretched technique's fault or your teacher's fault. It's you're not really there. So you need to pay attention to your way of life. Your way of life in an immediate ethical sense, but your way of life more broadly in terms of the circumstances of your life, the way you're living, your means of livelihood, your living context, and so on. All of that will have a drag on your spiritual practice. It is spiritual practice in itself, but that's another question. Unless you pay attention and reform it. So it all hangs together. You can't just take the mindfulness of breathing and add it on to a perfectly ordinary bourgeois consumer lifestyle and hope for the best. You may be lucky, you may have some karma from the past. You may have, you know, been an exalted Rinpoche in your last existence and you've got some residual, sorry, I'm getting flippant, influence from that. But, you know, more often than not, you cannot just add it on to an ordinary consumer life. You've got to reform your life, which means often also really coming into a critical relationship with the prevailing culture. So Sangharakshita's system goes right the way down. It goes ideas, things that you do to train your mind, and the whole basis on which you live. And especially in relation to the wider society, on which he has a very critical eye. This integrity, I think, is not sufficiently recognized among us, the way it all hangs together. We tend to have a supermarket view of it, that it's a wonderful Tesco of, the FWBOs are sort of Tescos of the spiritual supermarket. Sometimes it seems a bit more like Lidl, but that's another question. And you know, you just take the bits that you want and then you put them in your basket and leave. You have no responsibility to the market itself, as it were, and you know, you go to another market and add different things to it. It won't work. It'll only work to a very limited extent, or to the extent that you have a genuine spiritual insight and understanding, which you may have. I don't want to dispute that. But for most people, it won't work. So I think we need to recognize, honor that integrity and do what we can to safeguard it. This is part of my purpose in this this gathering, is to try to get a clearer representation of this integrity of the system and hopefully a deeper appreciation by all of us of the need to preserve that integrity. And even to safeguard it. Of course, that means not just blindly putting yourself into it. It's not that sort of system. But it means really making clear where areas of doubt and dissonance are and clarifying them. If you don't clarify them, or you find that in the end you're at odds, well, go and find another system. Don't just mix and match with this one. So, by and large, my own belief is that it does contain what we need. It's certainly capable of improvement. It's certainly capable of more assiduous application by us all. And it's capable of enlargement. It's not a rigid or fixed system. But for most people, nonetheless, it's fully adequate to their needs if they would only engage with it vigorously enough. I should just sort of digress a little bit to amplify this theme of capacity for development or of enlargement. It's possible to include new elements in that system, or to modify elements within it. But they need to be done, that modification or inclusion needs to be done in accordance with the system. So for instance, if you take a practice of meditation from outside that system and put it into that system without sort of bedding it in properly, you're bringing other ideas and influences and attitudes which may not work with the system that you've already got. So for instance, if you bring in practices embedded in the idea that you should not develop dhyana, which does go with some of these practices, which is fair enough within the practice itself. But if you import that in to the system of spiritual training that Sangharakshita has founded without tidying that up, you'll confuse yourself and you'll confuse those around. And I have heard that sort of confusion. I've been approached by people who telling me they're having difficulty not getting into dhyana. I say, you know, what a luxury, but why are you trying not to get into dhyana? Oh, well, because we're not supposed to get into dhyana. So they pick this up from some ways of teaching, you know, more sort of mindfulness-based practices, which are good in themselves. I mean, practices about being immediately aware of what's going on, in which you don't try to get into a more concentrated state. But you need to be careful that when you take that sort of practice, you clarify where it functions within the totality of the system. Otherwise, you spread confusion. Most of all, you confuse yourself. And most everything, every human production is bedded in views. An advertisement is bedded in views. A building is bedded in views. Look, this room here is bedded in the view that women should not participate in the service. Not and since it's been an LBC, FWBO place. But when it was a synagogue, the women sat upstairs in the gallery. So it represents certain sort of attitude to life. Every single human artifact is bedded in views. And mostly we're not aware of them. And so you buy the product and you get the view. It comes with it. And that goes for things in the spiritual sphere too. So quite a lot of work needs to be done to take things, critically examine them, explore their effectiveness, see how they fit in. And now that is a work that needs to be done. It shouldn't be a static system, but it's not for everyone. It's a sort of specialized sphere where it needs to be done carefully, intelligently, with quite a bit of experience, and collaboratively. It's not something just for an individual to suddenly get inspired and start teaching in a completely new way. Maybe all right, but often isn't. So, I need to conclude. I talked about the right attitude. I said that if you have the right attitude to this system and you put yourself into it thoroughly with that right attitude, it will work for you. So what is that right attitude? I'm trying to think about how to express this, and I've just been recently re-exploring an old Dharma category that actually isn't very much explored, the four Iddhipada, the four bases of spiritual power, which are said to be the means of gaining the siddhis, of walking through walls and multiplying yourself and appearing in different spaces at the same time. I'm not talking about that. You can use them like that, apparently, but they seem to me to be much more to do with the way to apply yourself to anything and get success, even if it's winning a rugby match. applying yourself wholeheartedly, thoroughly, and effectively. So the four Iddhipada are Chanda, Virya, Chitta, and Vimamsa. So how do I apply them here? Well, first of all, Chanda. I sort of think of that as emotional engagement, wholehearted emotional engagement, faith. And faith is not sort of blind faith, it's a faith in which you've clarified your doubts. You're not hesitant, you're not wavering. The Buddha says that if you try to apply yourself to spiritual practice with doubt in your mind, you will not succeed. It's one of those circularities, isn't it? Because you've got doubt in your mind, you don't succeed, so you say, see, I knew it wouldn't work. You need to have a sense of conviction as far as you can go, because of course it can only be as far as your it can't go beyond your experience very far, or only mediated by your experience of others. So you need to clarify your doubts and commit yourself much more fully and deeply to that system. And that's part of what I have in mind here, that we try to get a more wholehearted engagement with Sangharakshita's system of spiritual discipline by clarifying our doubts so that we can have lots and lots of chanda. Chanda is one of those wonderful words that is used both in the as it were, spiritually positive sense and in the negative sense. This is Sagramati's territory, as tanha is once or twice, which Sagramati's built a doctoral thesis on those once or twice. But chanda is, the kama chanda, the fixation, the addiction, if you like, to sense experience, especially pleasure. But dhamma chanda is the same sort of intense passion, but for the dhamma. So what you need is that sort of passion within the system. You need to believe in it. If you don't believe in it, it will not work for you. But that belief, this needs to be one that you've sort of explored. It's not something you are expected just to have. You know, people are at different stages even here. The order members, well, they were ordained because they were thought to believe in this. See? So those of you who have not joined the order, well, you're still perhaps trying to clarify things, or if you've asked for ordination, you've said, well, this is what I think. Please believe me. So yes, we need to have that wholehearted engagement with spiritual life. Otherwise, it won't work. Secondly, virya. Virya, really, in my understanding, is sometimes translated as enthusiasm and that sort of thing. But that's still a bit too like chanda for my taste. Really, virya, I think, is application of effort. It's actually making an effort, putting it into practice. So you need to not just, think it's wonderful and that it'll work and so on, but do it. Put your energy into it. Thirdly is citta, which seems to mean something like focus. It seems to mean the presence of your whole self, your whole mind, your whole heart and mind. In other words, you're wholehearted, but in more in the sense of being able to bring your entire attention to bear on what you're doing. So that you need to put yourself thoroughly and deeply into it. Not just your conscious, but as it were your unconscious. Even your dreams need to be engaged. Then fourthly, vimamsa, which is usually translated as something like investigation. But it seems to me to be really pointing to the engagement of intelligence. So that your engagement with that system is intelligent. It's critical in the positive sense that you are making aware what you don't understand. You're making conscious where you find areas of disagreement or doubt, and you're noticing that deeper sense of holding back. So you use your intelligence in the application of the system. And Sangharakshita perhaps rather unusually requires that sort of intelligence and is often belaboring us for not thinking clearly enough. For not even thinking at all in some cases, he would say. Not applying critical standards of reason, just sheer logic. He very, very highly values intelligence and sees intelligence not merely as a disconnected function of the personality, but as a sort of total function with the conceptualized intelligence as a sort of cutting edge. So we need to be intelligent in our application of the system, to apply ourselves to it critically. And this perhaps you could say balances the chanda. You need to have, as well as a sort of wholehearted engagement with it, a critical eye upon it. Critical eye on yourself as well. I heard somebody say recently that Buddhist meditation differs from all other forms of meditation because it requires the use of intelligence. In Buddhism, you're intelligently investigating your experience, both in the sense of the objects of experience, but also the subject of experience. You're applying your intelligence. So that we need to apply the whole system in this sort of spirit. We need a wholehearted faith and commitment to it, a belief in it. Otherwise it won't work. We need to actually put it into practice. We need to engage our whole selves to focus, to concentrate our energies upon it. And we need to be intelligent, even, in a sense, positively critical. Not sort of addictedly critical like so many of us are. You know, a critical brain that just won't stop. But a critical intelligence that's integrated into the totality of this approach. So, if you do all this, I'm personally firmly convinced that it will work for you, as I believe it's worked for me, to the extent that I've applied it. If there's been a lack, it's in me, not in the system. And not only will you get benefit from it, spiritually speaking, you'll pass it on to others. You'll be part of the means of that system coming to other people. And you'll add your own contribution to it. It'll be modified by your taking it on and practicing it and penetrating it. The more and more people who get to the bottom of it, so to speak, the more impetus it gets. But we need to approach the Dhamma recognizing that we're trainees, recognizing that there's something that we don't yet see. We've got some feeling for it, got some intuition of it, but we don't yet see it. And we engage with a teacher to try to lift ourselves beyond our present sort of perspective. The problem is that our perspectives are always self-consistent. So it all adds up. You know, when you come across something that's painful to you or difficult for you, you find an explanation for it that means you don't have to do anything about it. The function of a spiritual system is to support you, of course, but it's also to challenge you out of your presently achieved sort of compromise with reality. And we're trainees. In the modern context, there's such an emphasis on personal choice, on individuality, one might even say individualism, that we don't like to put ourselves in a relationship of pupillage. But we can't really succeed spiritually if we don't do that. We need to be brought out of what I've called our presently achieved set of compromises, which make us, if not comfortable, at least make us comfortable with our discomfort. And it's the function of a teacher, the function of spiritual friends, the function of a system of spiritual discipline to do that. And I believe that we're very, very fortunate to have that in a particularly uncomfortable form, as well as a very comfortable and satisfying one too. So I hope that gives you some food for discussion and reflection. I hope you've come across some areas where you're not really quite clear what I was getting at. Well, no, I don't hope that. But if you have, I hope you've noticed them and that you'll get them clarified or at least contradicted. And secondly, that you've noticed areas where you think to yourself, hey, wait a minute, I'm not sure I agree with that. That's wonderful. That's really good. Often we don't even notice that. So then you've got a chance to debate, to discuss, and perhaps to come up with questions to Bhante, where you can say to Bhante, you know, quite frankly, I think, dot, dot, dot. Thirdly, I hope you've come across some areas of sort of, I'm not quite sure I'm readily up for this. That's even better. That's the best thing of all. But if you stick with it, you'll come across deeper levels of discomfort, I can promise you. So I'll leave you to the tender mercies of the leaders of the groups, and you can try to explore these aspects of dukkha. And yes, I hope that we can come up with the kind of questions that nobody's ever asked Bhante before. Difficult to do, but the kind of questions that people will say, why didn't you ask him when you had him in front of you? Thank you.